Hey, welcome. I'm Chris Lopez, host of the Valley Pod, where we talk to all the interesting people of the San Luis Valley. Joining us today in our studio on the south side of Alamosa is Great Sand Dunes National Park Superintendent Andrea Compton. Pleasure to meet you, Superintendent. How are you?
Oh, great to be here, and thank you for this invitation.
Yeah, welcome to the Southside Alamosa. Welcome to the San Luis Valley. I know you're new in your role somewhat. You were an acting appointment, and then you got the permanent position.
Yeah.
I believe it was July. Take us there. Tell us how that happened.
That is correct. So in February, I came out from sunny San Diego and came out to the winter of Colorado and jumped in. And I was here February through May in what's called an acting assignment, kind of a temporary position. And partway through that, I learned that I was selected as the permanent position, so returned back home and closed out there, and then came out here in July and started permanent there. So delighted to be here.
Yeah, no, that's you know, I think you have the coolest job in the San Luis Valley, one of the coolest jobs in the state of Colorado, just being the superintendent of a national park, the Great Sand Dunes National Park. I think that job is just sounds cool, and I'm sure it is, but I don't know much about it. I don't know what a superintendent of a national park does. So I'm hoping you can give us a little bit of insight to what your day's like, what that role is like.
Sure, I'd be glad to help with that. It is my favorite job, too.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it is. Working for the Park Service is an interesting process. And for me, it actually merges my personal objectives with work objectives, right? And that's always the perfect place to be when you're in a work spot, right? So my background is in biology and ecology. So I have a strong interest in the environment. Likewise, I believe in education and teaching people about that and learning about that environment. That's what the Park Service is about as well. When you look back at the Organic Act that created the Park Service, it focuses on two different aspects. It has technical wording, but the 1916 wording focuses on conservation of the natural and cultural resources for this and future generations. So it talks about that, reaching out to the public, providing those opportunities, but not just for now, but for the future. And how do you do that for the future? Well, that's where the science comes in, because you have to study and understand those resources that are there in order to do your best to preserve them for the future. So I often think about, you know, if I'm ever giving a presentation to a kids group or anything, I ask them to vision. I'm like, okay, what do you think this place is going to look like 100 years from now? Right? Like, what would Alamosa look like 100
right.
years from now? And the Great Sand Dunes National Park and Preserve, it needs to be the same. So we need to capture that. There will be changes, right? It's not going to stay stagnant. But how do we make sure we preserve that into the future?
It seems to be withstanding the times.
Mm-hmm.
And not just the present times, but through its history, its evolution, first as a national park, as a national monument, as a national park. And I don't even know how it got designated or discovered before it was a national monument. I don't know that history. But it seems to have withstood the conditions of the San Luis Valley, including the present conditions. Is that surprising?
Yeah. So one of the things that I, you know, when you look at back at history, like, okay, well, how does the Great Sand Dunes, when were they observed or discovered, and how do they change over time? So one of the things I like to think about is when Zebulon Pike came through and observed it, and he said, oh, it's like, it looks like a sea in a storm, right? I like that phrase. Mm-hmm. Right. When I was leaving San Diego, people were saying, oh, you're leaving the ocean. I'm like, no, I'm just going to a sandy ocean now. It'll still look like a sea of sand. And as we move forward, just the interest in that area, right? Like the creation of national monuments, the creation of national park sites is often driven by citizens. And so what Great Sand Dunes National Monument, as we got to 2000, the citizens of the San Luis Valley approached the Park Service about creating a national park and kind of changing that and actually adding protection. So it was driven by water rights.
Right.
So that's what led to the creation of Great Sand Dunes National Park and the separate part, which is the preserve, and kind of that protection from all the way up in the Alpine, all the way down into the valley as well. And so do things change? Yes, they change over time, right? So every year we measure the amount of sand that is in the 30 square miles of Great Sand Dunes National Park. We also look at what's changing with the condition of the landscape. You know, the ranch that was fairly recently acquired, what a wonderful contribution to the national park as a whole. And we have to understand the conditions of that as the ranching that's occurring on that now changes over time. How do we move that towards a more natural situation? So that's another aspect that the Park Service does, is if we look at a disturbed area or an area that's had a lot of activity and we want to take it back to a natural condition, how do we get it there? How do we map it out?
It's also a good barometer of the valley lands as a whole, the environment of the valley as a whole. Is that accurate that it is? I mean, I would think that it's a good barometer of where we stand just naturally in the San Luis Valley today.
Yeah. Well, and I would say just not the San Luis Valley, but the whole region, right? If we look at what's happening in the mountains, what's happening, you know, we see this often in a fire season, right? If it's a strong fire season in one area, it's often throughout the region. But yeah, like lower water. So this year we see a lot lower water. I understand July and August were some of the driest months since, I think, 2002, I think is what one of our resources people mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So we think about that. Like, what does that look like for the future? And I think about it, what does that mean for the farmers in the San Luis Valley and the agricultural and the products that are happening there? It influences everybody, right? It influences the farmers, but it also influences the natural environments as well.
How do you, as superintendent, get those daily readings or those monthly readings of how the park is doing, how it's doing with its water flows in, how it's doing with any wind issues? How do you see those gauges, I guess? I'm imagining you as a CEO, and like a lot of CEOs, there's gauges that are presented to them so they can see how things are performing, right? Is that a accurate analogy of what how a superintendent sees things?
So there's two parts of it. So if I go back to the Organic Act, there is an element of what's the status of our natural and cultural resources, but also what's the pulse of our visitors, right? So that's another thing that changes over time. But relative to the natural resources, yes, we have, you know, when you think about an organization and the different divisions that are in that organization, in the Park Service, many units, including ours, has five different units. So there's administration and facilities and maintenance. There's an interpretation division. But one of those divisions is resources. And so this is the team that is specifically focusing on what is the condition of how's our pika population doing? How are the dunes themselves, right? So they go out every year and they measure the heights of the dunes and those locations of the dunes. How is our water? So we do have a process of monitoring wells where we, measure the water levels, record water usage. We report those, submit that information. So we're woven into water usage that's kind of around the state. There's a resources team. And anytime we have a project coming up, we work with that resources team to really understand, okay, if we do this project, what are the potential impacts? You know, everything from insects, any biological things, to sensitive, threatened, endangered species. And then we also look at physical attributes as well. How does it affect night skies? How does it affect air quality? How does it affect our soundscape? So we're looking at some of those subtleties so that we maintain that quality of experience for the visitors as a whole.
You know, you've been in different national parks, Joshua Tree National Park, I believe. You've been in other national parks in the system.
Yep.
And I wonder if you can give us some insights or some sense of how a region like the San Luis Valley, how Alamosa benefits from having a national park in its backyard, because there are all sorts of benefits to the community, to the valley as a whole. I mean, even just to what you're talking about in terms of paying attention to water flows and helping everyone understand that. I mean, you, as a national park, I would think you also are a major resource of information. And, I mean, we know about the economic impact of the Great Sand Dunes National Park. It's what drives tourism. We know that, 600,000, whatever it is, people a year.
Yeah.
But I wonder if you can give us a different sense of just how meaningful it is to have a national park in your backyard.
Yeah, so there's two parts of that. So one, you mentioned the economics, but I would like to kind of relay, I'm a scientist at heart, I relayed that to you, or that's kind of my background. So every year, the Park Service as a whole, for every unit in the Park Service, looks at the economic values that those units bring to their local communities. So whether it is jobs, whether it is the additional income from people coming and staying in hotels and working in restaurants, that is all an addition, an economic addition that is brought to the local community. So I wanted to read, and they always put this together in a kind of a phrasing that describes how having a National Park Service unit nearby contributes to that. So what we have for 2022, 493,000 park visitors spent an estimated $32.5 million in local gateway regions while visiting Great Sand Dunes National Park and Preserve. These expenditures supported a total of 408 jobs, $100.7 million in labor income, $18.7 million in value added, and $36 million in economic output in local gateway economies surrounding the park and the preserve. So this, it is a substantial contribution. I think that was one when the local communities were approaching the then National Monument about a national park and preserve. That's one of the things they were thinking about, is the additional things. And we have strong partnerships that kind of working with, like, Visit Alamosa,
right.
Different groups
right.
towards that element. So that's kind of the economic part. The other part I wanted to relay is a big part of the National Park Service. You were kind of asking, what do we contribute, right? Like, how does that interact?
Well, I want, because I'm a native of Alamosa in the Valley. And
yes.
At times I think we as natives take the National Park for granted. That because it's there. You know,
yes.
I'm 62. I've seen it for 62 years.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah.
But I do think we, as a community, can take it for granted and not really understand the jewel that we have. That's why I asked that question.
Yeah. So there's lots of different ways that we rely on local communities and local members. And part of it is kind of in support of the parks, in support of the Park Service. When we have events coming up, you know, so we try to relay information about those events that are occurring. If we opened up we had a major remodeling of our visitor center, for example, this past summer, and we had a grand opening. And it's fantastic to have locals present and supporting for that. One of the things is volunteerism. So we just have a few volunteers at the park, but that having volunteers present, wanting to assist, wanting to be a part of that, a part of the park, and this is true for any National Park Service unit, that makes such a difference. Some of the things we do with, like, we have a camp store, and that's run as a concession, so that's usually someone local trying to figure out and are trying to work that business into the group. We have several different, we have a friends group that is very supportive of the park and tries to financially help. So Friends of the Dunes is an important partner. Western National Park Association is actually the group that runs our bookstore So sometimes it's supporting through those organizations as well.
You know, I should ask you, because of the current conversations in Congress and maybe they're not going to get a new budget, how does a stoppage affect the national park, the Great Sand Dunes National Park? How would a stoppage in government affect your operations, if they do at all?
Well, so that's what we have to define, and we don't know anything right now.
Right.
I don't have a lot of details. We hope that Congress and the president can resolve this, and so we can continue providing services to visitors and things like that. But we don't, right now we don't know, and it varies. It has varied over time as far as what services can be provided or access. So we really have to wait and hear from current administration on guidance on that.
Gotcha. You know, one of the things that you've talked about, there are two parks there. There's the national park with the sand dunes, Great Sand Dunes, and then there's the National Park Preserve. Mm-hmm. And really want to get a better sense of the preserve end of operations. Specifically, there was a transfer of 9,300 acres of the Zapata Ranch Preserve, almost a year ago, October 2022.
Yeah.
What's transpired or what's happened since that announcement, or explain the significance of that transaction and then the preserve and the work there?
Yeah. So there's two different parts to your question. So one is, and I'll address kind of the 9,300 acres. And so this is actually in the national park itself. So that was when the park was created, one of the contingents. So the previous ranch owner wanted to preserve it, wanted to save it, use it for conservation. The Park Service was interested in this, but we don't have instant funding. Right. It just the wheels of bureaucracy.
Right.
It takes a while to sort that out. The Nature Conservancy was a wonderful partner, and they stepped in and purchased these 9,300 acres while the Park Service is gathering those funds to make that transfer. And there's a larger amount. It's actually closer to 12,000 total. The 9,300 is what was transferred in ownership last year. So a wonderful step forward that direction. So that will stay in the National Park Service system. Right now, the Nature Conservancy has a bison operation that they are still maintaining and will continue, as far as we know, for the next 6 years or so. In 2029, that bison project will be removed, so that will come off of the park. And then that will truly transfer fully to the Park Service.
They just want to,
yeah,
because that's an interesting operation in itself, the bison herd that the conservation is working through.
Yeah.
What is the Great Sand Dunes National Park and Preserve, once you get management of that herd?
Yeah.
What's then the plan, or how do you, as a park, what's the plan?
Yeah, so this is actually a pretty interesting project kind of moving forward. So the herds that's there is actually treated as a little bit as livestock. So every year, so there's a limit of the number of animals that can be there. The Great Sand Dunes National Park and Preserve has been identified as one of the parks nationally that's going to be a part of a bison recovery plan. So through the Department of Interior, with Secretary Holland, they have identified a core set of parks that will be part of a national system. And that includes working with tribes. That includes working between parks. So right now what we anticipate is that bison herd from the Nature Conservancy will be moved or removed. So they're trying to think about that kind of into the future. And we will be introducing a smaller herd to begin with of animals, and this is just planning right now, and those will be more wild. So right now there's a fence around the herd, a large fence, and it's designed to keep the public safe, so it's kind of an area that's closed to the public. But in the future, the fence will come down and the bison will be more free roaming. And so they will roam not only on Park Service lands, but on Fish and Wildlife Service lands. So all of this is really in the initial stages.
See, this is why I say you have the coolest job in Alamosa, San Luis Valley. We'll be right back. We're with Andrea Compton. She's the superintendent at the Great Sand Dunes National Park. You can support the work of AlamosaCitizen.com by becoming a member or by donating today. We have no out-of-town shareholders or billionaire owners. We are 100% San Luis Valley. Go to AlamosaCitizen.com and hit Become a Member or give anything that you can. We appreciate it. Hey, we're back. We're talking to Andrea Compton. She's the superintendent at the Great Sand Dunes National Park. She was telling us about the buffalo herd and what's happening there, but you were also explaining the significance, the importance, and the benefits of the preserve park, the National Preserve Park, that's attached to the Great Sand Dunes National Park. Take us back to the preserve developments.
I will, and it's exciting. You know, those is one of the things that I think is special about this area, among many, is that those two units are, they're two units of the 425 in the National Park Service. So not many areas get to claim two, but we do. And that all came about when there was the creation of the national park. So one of the things that we do with the National Park Service as a federal agency is get public comments, public involvement, public engagement as we're making decisions moving forward. We ask the public, what do you want to do? What's important to you? How do we make this place important to you? And one of the feedback, this is my understanding that came back, was that there was support from going to a national monument to a national park, but there was two elements that were important to preserve. And one of those was that the area that used to be U.S. Forest Service land and is still adjacent to U.S. Forest Service land, that hunting be maintained. So hunting, trapping, fishing still be maintained as a use in that area. And then the other was that it be a dog-friendly place.
Uh-huh.
And so the National Preserve was created, you know, and again, this was the citizens were looking at protection of a watershed. So this is a pretty an important element that from the top of the kind of the top of the ridgeline, coming down through the forest, coming down across the dunes and into that old lake bed, that it be preserved in its entirety. So the National Preserve, with a capital P, is kind of the eastern portion. The national park is to the west and, of course, covers the dune area itself. And so that national preserve has a little bit more flexibility in its use. So hunting occurs there, right, as we're now in archery season and starting to see that use. Camping is even an example. Like in the national park, it's more specific about where you can camp, where in the national preserve, it's a little bit more open. There's still guidelines. You can't, you know, certain distances from streams or waters, but it's also more flexibility. So, so a little bit more, I would say, latitude, still protection in both. So there's still wilderness in both. So managing for wilderness values in both of those areas is still important. And there is no difference kind of management-wise how we approach the different things. You know, I mentioned 425 different sites in the National Park Service system. Those include national trails, national recreation areas, you know, seashores, national historic sites, national monuments. They all are under the same management guidelines. So we all manage them the same ways. National parks are not any different than smaller units. And the same way here, National Preserve and National Monument or National Park are no different in how we manage them. It's just in the type of use that is allowed.
As the superintendent of the National Park and the National Preserve, are there areas where you can leave your imprint or leave your contribution or your mark or leave your vision of what you think should happen during your tenure as superintendent? Is that a thing in the national park?
It is.
Yeah.
You know what? But it's all about teamwork, right? So I've just been here a few months, but we are going through some major planning efforts that will last well into the future. And so I really rely on the team that is there, their expertise, their knowledge, their experience with visitors in the winter, visitors in the summer, visitors to Medno Creek, just kind of across the board. What happens when the dune parking lot is overflowing? What happens when we have to park people along the road because we don't have enough parking structures? So one of these planning efforts is called a transportation and transit plan. So this actually started last fall. The park went, in the past 5 years, visitation has really doubled. We went from around 270,000 people to more than 525,000. So when you start to think about, okay, what are the impacts to Colorado's beach? That's what I've heard referred to in the spring, right?
Right,
we
right.
It's a draw from people. The Front Range, local, Texas,
yeah,
kind of all over. Well, what does that mean for waiting lines, for, you know, people waiting to get into the park, trying to find a parking spot? What does it mean if they want to go to the visitor center, but there's no room to park? What about the campground? How do all these things play in? So our transportation plan and transit planning is actually looking at just that. We're looking at, there were last year, there were visitor surveys that were done.
Right.
And it was kind of that one-on-one, they interacted with the public and had a whole series of questions for them. You know, how long of a wait line is too long? When do you get frustrated that you're still waiting in line? You know, right now we put out porta potties in the springtime because we know that people are waiting in line and maybe they've driven for a while, so they need a break. But porta potties are not a long-term solution.
Right.
So it's putting all these things together, as you know. So we know, like, people like to stop at the entrance sign. Okay, how do we design that better? How do we anticipate people's needs better? And how do we plan for this in the future? And next March, this is where public involvement comes. We're going to have some public sessions asking for the public's input on the ideas that we're thinking about. We're working with a couple other offices, our regional office and kind of a transportation group of specialists, and trying to develop, here's what we're thinking about doing, and then getting feedback from the public about that next March. So that's another thing, kind of going back to how can you help? Yeah,
right.
It's that public involvement aspect.
The customer service surveys that you did last summer, two summers ago.
Yeah.
What were the indicators that you paid attention to or that you saw coming in as acting and now the full superintendent? What were the indicators from that survey or what came out of it that you, pro or con, whatever, that you said, yeah, this was a worthwhile effort?
Yeah, so some of it is the interesting parts are hearing people's perspectives. So the things that resonated, especially for me, as I think we move into the planning effort, relates to the wait time. So actually, so at Cabrillo National Monument, which is where I was superintendent before, and I came here, wait time at the entrance station, you know, they were fine with 30 minutes, right? It didn't really, you know, you're in a city, you've got internet, or you've got cell phone coverage, right? So you got things to do in your car. I think people in general are used to sitting in their cars for a while. So 30 minutes was no big deal there. But here, 15 minutes was kind of the cutoff. Like at 15 minutes, people were kind of frustrated with sitting in their cars, you know, ready to do something different, ready to get there. Let's get there. Let's get to this park. So we think about, okay, how do we split up that wait time a little bit? One of the interesting things that we've done already is actually a simple thing like connectivity. So we've changed some of our connectivity at the park. The staff have done a great job. So we have a faster internet. So now we can move people through the entrance station faster, right? We can still greet them and say, welcome to the park. But we get them through faster, and so the line is shorter. With some of this transportation planning, we think about an earlier stop before they get to the entrance station. Is there a place where they could stop at the entrance sign, for example? Get out there, go up to a view spot, read some about the park. So we're kind of splitting up some of that use a little bit.
Gotcha.
Kind of managing that.
Really interesting. You know, you also have private property owners that you work with or are adjacent to you. You know, you have a conservationist, Lewis Bacon, to the east of you. You have, how do you work with private property owners in management of the preserve in particular? Because I think that's probably where you have more private property engagements.
Yeah. So I would say one of the things that I've liked in general and been very impressed with here is the partnerships with neighbors just in general. So, we have neighbors of Fish and Wildlife Service and the state parks, and that kind of cross communications, and it's a very positive one. And the same, we try to mirror the same with our private neighbors. So, for example, that are just adjacent, it's, again, kind of working with them. What's working? I know we have one situation where there's a water right that actually goes to the east and goes to one of the landowners there. And then at a certain time, that switches over and comes back to the park. So that's an example of there is an agreement that was set up. I don't know how long ago. But kind of recognizing that that was a historic water right and continues through to today.
Yeah.
So we try to, the same we do with anyone, whether it's someone visiting or if it's someone nearby, we are here to hear their concerns.
Yeah, I'd imagine there's just a myriad of relationships you have to manage, including with other state federal partners. We wrote a story, Alamosa Citizen, recently, and I want to get your thoughts about it. To the south of us is the New Mexico National Monument at the Gorge Bridge, the Rio Grande Gorge Bridge there, just outside of Taos.
Yeah.
And there's a effort now to extend that National Monument into the San Luis Valley in Colorado to go from the Alamosa Wildlife Refuge up through Lobato's Bridge into the Gorge.
Yeah.
And that would be an extension of the National Monument. At least those are conversations that are currently underway locally.
Right.
What are you just, because, you know, when I think of the Great Sand Dunes National Park and I think of the Rio Grande Gorge Bridge, not far away to the north, and I see this whole region just connected between the national park that you are the superintendent of, the New Mexico Monument, and everything in between.
Yeah.
Is this fascinating history of civilization. We photographed petroglyphs in that area recently. I mean, there's so much civilization that has happened.
Yeah.
Through 10,000 years, right?
Yep.
How do you see that as a superintendent? How would you see something like that if someone said, hey, we want the National Monument, keep coming. You're right there. I mean, it's like, let's do it.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
That's just me.
Yeah. Well, so I think, number one, kind of this amazing collection of people's use of this area, right? So one of the things to me is I think how intertwined the natural environment is with the use of that people have been here and have been present. So we look back at that old lake bed, right? And so the lake bed was kind of the creation of the park. Well, that lake bed is now where agriculture occurs, right? Whether it's plants, whether it's livestock. And as we move forward into time, you know, kind of indigenous peoples and their use of the area, as you've kind of referred to, kind of throughout this landscape, and using it in different ways as we move forward. As I mentioned, the Spanish explorations and kind of settlement of this valley, as we move forward into Pike's exploration and their encounter, and then moving forward, the Spanish Trail, settlers, the miners, right? It's all woven into the environment. So when you look at this kind of lane, people's use across the environment, I think it's also an interesting proposal is how do you continue to make the best use of that and preserve that use for the future? How do you continue both kind of the people that are here now and their use now? How do you explain the historic use to people and do a good job of explaining that historic use of the people? And so creation of national monuments or is there areas that need to be protected and that by protecting them, you can tell the story better of both the natural area but also the cultural components of that? It's an interesting proposal, right? It's an interesting element. And it's, you know, from a habitat standpoint, you know, habitat connectivity is always an important element, right? With animal management, the biggest concerns are kind of fragmentation of habitats.
Mm-hmm.
And so the more you can connect those, the better. There's lots of natural connections in Colorado, right? Lots of mountains that are already in federal protection. So it's just, I don't know enough about these new proposals and what's, but I always listen with interest of what are the connections. I heard about a proposed trail, you know, through a lot of the San Luis Valley, again, kind of thinking about different uses and how people can find things they like to do or connect to their place. So it's always interesting how these things evolve, right? How are they going to settle out?
And there is a heritage culture tour that people like to go on. We do seem to want to discover our history, our roots, and in the San Luis Valley, the heritage of the place in the Great Sand Dunes National Park plays a huge role there. But I don't think we ever connect the Great Sand Dunes National Park to our heritage as much as we probably should or we should recognize that.
Yeah. So one of the things that I thought was just fascinating our rangers are often giving individual tours, right? They're giving ranger talks. They're either at the visitor center or they do guided walks or something like that. So I went along on one that was to a culturally modified tree. So this is kind of a ponderosa, and indigenous peoples would do kind of a peeling of the bark. I don't think we know why. Perhaps for sugar, I think it was one of the idea, a very sweet. There's a big collection at the park. That is now discussed in some of our new visitor center displays as well. So that's kind of making that connection. We do partner with Sangre de Cristo National Heritage Area. So that's, again, that's just what you're referring to, right? Trying to make those connections. The rangers that I mentioned do give good talks, very informed talks. They are trying to relay that information. And there's good, they post all of the current talks for the week on our website. So www.nps.gov/GRSA for Great Sand Dunes. And if you look at ranger talks, then they keep that posted with kind of what's coming up or what's occurring.
I want to ask you one more question before we let you go, and we really appreciate all your time because, you know, there's a lot of young people here in the San Luis Valley who get outdoors.
Yeah.
And they explore and they hike and they wonder, how does someone become a superintendent of a national park? What was your educational pathway into the national park system for young people out there that want to pursue outdoor education, careers, what you do for a living? Because, again, you have the coolest job in Alamosa.
Like I said, I think it's the coolest job. I might be a little biased. So I'll give you kind of my background. So, you know, people say, how did you get here from San Diego?
Right.
And actually, I went to grad school at Colorado State. And my and that was in wildlife biology. And my field site was near Sawatch. It was at Trickle Mountain.
There you go.
And so when I saw this job was posted, I was like, oh, that would be a great chance to get back to Colorado. But so what was the route that I went through? So after grad school, I went to the Northwest up near Portland, and I worked for an environmental consulting firm. And then I went to Southern California, and I was in academia there. So I taught a local community college, taught biology, did a little bit of that. But I also started volunteering with the Park Service. And that was one thing, is I learned that the Park Service hires ologists. They hire geologists and biologists and archaeologists. And so that was actually my entry into the National Park Service. I was volunteering at Cabrillo National Monument. And when the position of the manager of natural resources opened up, I applied for it, and that was my entry into the Park Service. And from there, I went to, in the Park Service, you apply for jobs. So you don't, if you want to move or you're interested, you just start seeing what's listed, and then you apply elsewhere. So from there, I went to Joshua Tree National Park and managed natural and cultural resources. And then from there, I was trying to think about, okay, what's next, right? I could either go stay in the natural realm, or I could think about this superintendent route. And there's some very intriguing aspects of that, right? Like you're guiding and facilitating discussions. I really like the kind of facilitating aspect of it, right? Like I said, I'm here for a few months. I don't know hardly anything about Greenland, but I have a great team that does, right? So using their knowledge. So I thought, I'm going to try this. So when Cabrillo National Monument opened up, as the superintendent opened up, I applied for it. And so that's how I got there. And then, of course, out here, which I've already explained. So one of the things I would really recommend for your listeners, all the jobs for federal agencies across the board is posted at usajobs.gov. And you can even set up a, like I have some of my nieces and nephews who are thinking about careers. And I say, you know what you can do is go to USA Jobs and just set up a email trigger, right? Like do a search on biologist and get all the jobs that are listed as biologist. Or if you want to stay in Alamosa, just list a location that you want to know about all the jobs that show up in Alamosa, Colorado. So you can start to get a sense of what are the different types of jobs that are offered. Another thing that I want to mention is a really good experience is through public land corps. And this is something that a lot of federal agencies are using more. It's experience for especially young adults coming out of college is to get some on-the-ground experience. And then we have some hiring authorities that we can use to bring some of those people on board. There are also opportunities for veterans for hiring. So for those who I appreciate their service, there are some special hiring for veterans as well. So USA Jobs is the place. Kind of think about public land corps. Volunteer is a way to get in as well, at least to get familiar with a place,
right?
And what they do and how they work.
Right.
Those are all different ways.
Really good career advice. We really appreciate that. And again, really appreciate all the time that you've given us today in the Valley Pod. Hey, you've been listening to the Valley Pod in our episode with Andrea Compton. She's a superintendent with the Great Sand Dunes National Park. The Valley Pod is produced by Owen Woods and is part of the AlamosaCitizen.com podcast lineup. We'll see you around the valley.
Hi, I'm Marty Jones, host of the Outdoor Citizen Podcast. Join us every other Wednesday as we talk to outdoor enthusiasts, wildlife experts, recreationists, lovers of the outdoors, and people who spend their days and their lives outside. On the Outdoor Citizen, we talk all things outside and outdoors, provide you with the latest data and measurements for water and weather, give you upcoming outdoor events, and keep you up to date on the latest news. The Outdoor Citizen is brought to you by the AlamosaCitizen.com podcast lineup. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, enjoy the out of doors.